be loving you always with a love that's true.
That's pretty good, isn't it, for Wednesday night? Pretty good. Now, any other requests? How about Marie? That's a very good tune on a Wednesday night for those of you who would like to wander down the memory lane. Or perhaps...
Every little breeze seems to whisper, Louise, even the trees seem to...
You know, a lot of people think that there hasn't been progress made in the world. But I beg to differ with those people. Because I think in some of the most important aspects of existence, there has been great progress, great strides forward. For example, that kind of singer is now limited to late, very bad movies that were made in 1936 that appear on the late movie just before the early morning Latin semester thing starts on Channel 6 SJ7. And you find him, you know, Walt, have you noticed that guy wandering down through rose flowers there?
I'll be loving you with a love that's true. I'll be loving you always.
It's a very, very good thing about that. It's kind of, you might say, the Nelson Eddy Dick Foran syndrome. By the way, I wonder what Dick Foran is doing these days, huh? Tune, Fred. It's a lovely thing. Now, for all the gang out at Corky's, out in the Staten Island, where they're having that wonderful pajama party, we'd like to love a parade. Oh, speaking of parades, little news note just came in here a couple of hours ago that I didn't hear on the newscast. I'm sorry that they didn't mention it. But it seems that down in the big airline terminal, down in Miami, got this big airline terminal. I think it's Eastern. Doesn't matter. It's one of the big airline terminals, and it seems that there's been a mysterious visitor has gotten a hold of the microphone from time to time down there. You know the PA system that they have in these big terminals, the one that says,
Platform 7, airplane number 17, over Chicago, Miami, Newark. Now boarding on ramp 4.
You know that thing? Well, somebody gets to that PA system down there in Miami about every couple of hours, and nobody knows how or why, and he plays taps over it. Well, I don't know whether you have boarded a plane to the sound of taps ever in your life, but, you know, taps doesn't only mean lights out, fellas. It means lights out. It's a very different kind. Ta-ta-ta, 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 la-ta-ta, la-ta-ti, la-ta-ta. Now, look, that was a solemn moment of quiet, reverent consideration. You like that, don't you? Yeah, you're like that. You're getting a little bit hung on that. Be careful. You know what the next step is. Hashish.
Oh, yeah. Nothing goes better with a koto than...
Now, any more requests? You really like that? Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And now, for the gang out of Charlie's, we would like to play the cricket. This is the sound of a cricket calling to its mate in a late October day, late in the fall, just as the cold chill of winter begins to set in, and the cricket is aware that his life is coming to an end. Cricket is dying. He expires quietly as the moon appears through the eucalyptus tree. And there is the answering call from his mate. And now a last joyous surge. Cricket has died. Now, any other requests out there? Speaking of, it's funny how you get pulled right into those things. It's Peter Lind Hayes and Mary Healy are coming to WOR Radio starting Monday, September 13th. That starts the 30th of September. It's a very exciting program. And, we have another thing here. It says, your contribution to chronic diseases, Brooklyn 3, New York, will help carry on essential medical research. I don't know why they put this right after Peter. Essential medical research and rehabilitation. That's a good cause. It's funny. Hearing that little piece about taps reminded me of a story. Done them both, Ted. Yeah, see, caught them right in there, right? Happened there very fast. But you didn't hear them. Well, I did them. Yes, tell them, Walt. It's terrible. It's awful how these things have. They got a bad speaker out there. It doesn't work so good. Well, that comes later. You don't want to do it too soon. See, it's 3 minutes before the station break time, and that's illegal. 2 minutes. No. I have a 6-minute leeway here, and I'm going to use every last minute of it. Yeah. ask, well, you know, speaking of taps and the sound of taps being played over a PA system, did I ever tell you about the wild time that somebody did that? I saw that actually happen in the Army, and it was a galvanic moment. Taps in the Army has a very special connotation. It has much more than lights out. It's a very strange feeling. I wonder how many guys who are sitting around out there scratching and spitting and you know, having another thing, you know, just sitting around. I wonder how many guys out there remember the first time that you were in the Army and you really began to feel and you knew you were in the Army, the first moment when you had that vague, funny sensation of it's no longer play, you know, it's not for fun. And they're not kidding. And, you know, all the rest of it. And somehow it's peculiarly connected up in my mind with taps. I recall one time, the only time that it ever happened to me. I got into the Army. I was in the Army about 2 or 3 days, and it was so wild, you know, the first couple of days, running around and hollering and in this induction center. And it was like a giant nightmare. And you can't really make sense out of a nightmare, you know. It's like trying to make sense out of trying to catch a subway in an enormous subway station where there are 6,000 trains all going in the opposite direction, all in a big revolving platform, and numbers are being shouted, and you can't quite make any sense or any kind of real pattern out of it. You know what I mean by that? There's no pattern at all. I wonder when somebody is going to do a real movie about the Army. Really, you know how it really is. It's a wild scene to find. Speaking of wild scenes, this is WOR AM and FM New York, and I'll tell you, this station is really wild. It's funny. It's getting wilder and wilder. You know, I thought for one moment this morning that John Gambling was going to play a rock and roll record. For one moment there, he had the sound in his voice, but I'm pleased to report to you that Voices of Spring, played by the Sears Roebuck String Orchestra, came out on schedule. For a moment there, I thought we were going to have, and the Norman Luboff Choir sang the time, which kind of helped things. And Matt Devani played the station break. All on schedule. It was kind of nice there. Well, you want to hear the story about that night? That night the taps really sank in? Oh, it was a scary night. And after about 3 nights in the Army, while we were waiting to get shipped, and my suit was scratching everywhere, it had tags that were sticking me in very embarrassing places, and my shoes were squeaking, and it's very hard, you know, to get used to wearing wool shirts. They make you wear wool shirts in the Army when you're hanging around the camp and it's winter time and you have to get dressed. They holler Class B uniform, and you put on a wool shirt. This is something that very few guys ever do in civilian life, that kind of shirt. You know, Walt, this is really wool. It's like a very fine grade of sandpaper. And, yes, it is. And I guess it's an extension of the hair shirt principle. Maybe the sackcloth and ashes idea fits there, too, because they want to remind you where you are. You're not back home in Hessville. You know, they want to let you know that you're in a very new and a very different environment. And so everything scratches in the Army, even the ties. They got scratchy ties, if you can, and scratchy socks. And there is nothing scratchier, believe me, than Army underwear. And when you are standing out there in the biting, freezing cold, and you are wearing G.I. Long Johns being made apparently out of old used Brillo pads that they've ground up and that they've saved from, you know, from the scrap drives and stuff. Those are Long Johns. Oh, boy. And then on top of that, you put on a wool shirt that is of the hair shirt variety. It's made out of hair. It's not made out of wool. There's a difference between lambs. Well, girly, it's not quite cashmere. This is made out of the big, fat, coarse hair of some awful creature. And it makes an interesting... I don't even know what kind of creature. Because when it got wet in the wintertime, it didn't smell like wool smells. Somehow, I think they must have gotten very close to some camels or something when they made these. And it was, some kind of awful animal. It smelled terrible when it got wet. I don't know. off of his shirt that did that. Well, this is the kind of thing, and about the third or fourth day, Eddie, I am still going through this wild scene, trying to get used to the shoes and everything in the Army. And then finally came that moment when I began to look around. Jack, do you remember the first day when you began to really look around in the Army, the strange feeling that you really were in another world? You know that? And Jack remembers it. And how, boy. And it's very exciting at first and very scary. It's like suddenly you are made out of cream of wheat or more like tapioca pudding you're made out of. Well, it came to me, I would say, about 9 o'clock on the third day in the Army. I had finished my meal, and I was in this big mess hall, and I went out into the cold, and I'm walking around with my overcoat, and I have been working to the bone. My body, I'm sweating, I'm tired, and now no longer can I believe in the nightmare. And I'm beginning to look around. And I see this long row of gray buildings, which up to that time had just been the barracks, the places where you're always used to things being sort of impermanent in civilian life. You can move, you know? Well, I see the barracks all lined up there as far as the eye could see, and way down at the end of the street there was a high metal fence keeping me in there. And it was bitter cold. The wind was coming in off the lake, and this was Fort Sheridan. You heard of Fort Sheridan? And I looked around, and I could see just as far as the eye could see these square, gray, white barracks in this bitter, cold temperature. Oh, it was cold. Well, I walked and I walked. I thought, well, I'm going to walk. I was feeling kind of blue. It's a very funny feeling. I was feeling kind of, you know, that feeling of just being vaguely depressed, and you didn't know exactly what you were depressed about, and yet you had a very vague suspicion that you knew what you were depressed about, and you didn't want to think about it. It's like a guy must feel when he suspects he has some unbelievably pernicious, incurable disease, and he doesn't want to think about it. And so he goes to the show, or he has a beer, or he plays pinochle, and he laughs it up. And he doesn't want to think about it. He just walks away and keeps thinking, and yet it keeps gnawing and nibbling away at the bottom. Well, I'm clumping down the company street, and I'm walking towards what they call Service Club Number 2. And I get about halfway down there, and I've been there a couple of nights, and all you do is sit around, and there's always a guy up on the balcony somewhere typing. It's the first time I ever saw typewriters that had dimes attached to them. You put a dime in a slot, and the typewriter works for 8 minutes. Yeah, you know, and that was so unfair, because I was a rotten typist. And, you know, for 8 minutes, I got about nine words down, and all the other guys, they go like that, you know, they knock off 7 letters in 8 minutes. And so I thought, well, that's for the birds. And I walked around, and it was getting colder and later and later and later. And I just walked, and there was a big section there where they had wax. And I didn't think anything about it. You know, I was just out of civilian life. You know, girls you take for granted in civilian life. And I'm walking along, and I didn't realize it, but I had come to the wax section. And I was walking along a company street. Now, this is something you don't see very much in the movies, but this is the way it was. And I'm walking along the company street, and I didn't know it, but I was in Wackville. It looked exactly like the other place. Gray, cruddy looking white barracks, and the wind is blowing. And I can see the back end of a couple of barracks. For some reason or other, I was around the back. And I remember a scene. It's funny. It's emblazoned in my mind. And I remember the scene where the barracks in the back was opened up. Somebody had opened up the doorway. It was hot or something. They were letting in some air. And I saw a bunch of chicks sitting around in these real sacky-looking fatigues that they gave the wartime wax. They were not dressed like they are now, girls. There are a whole bunch of women sitting around in these sacky-looking dresses under a yellow light bulb. And around, they were sitting around what looked like a great big wash tub of some kind. And they were just sort of huddled around this under the light bulb. I have no idea what they were doing, but it was one of the grimmest pictures I can ever remember seeing. These sacky fatigues, tired, angry-looking women. They weren't the pretty little wacks that you always see played by Audrey Hepburn, you know, that kind of thing. No, they were all sitting around under a yellow light bulb, and I am walking down this company street, and I glance in, and I see the scene, and just as I go past, I hear somebody saying something, and one of these girls, and she's hollering at another girl who is apparently in another part of the barracks, and she is swearing. And I mean swearing. Oh, yeah, I mean the real stuff. And it just hit me as so indescribably sordid. I mean, the whole scene was so sordid. I'd never seen this side of war. You know, the side of war never is entered into by Errol Flynn or Don Ameche or Van Johnson or even Rip Torn. It just is never there. You know, there's always nice, clean stuff like guys throwing grenades at one another. Somehow, everything was cruddy. You know, Esther Jane Albury, I could never, you know, all the chicks that I had known, and they were yelling at each other. And I go wandering off in the general direction now. It's about an hour and a half. I've been walking around, and the camp is practically pitch dark. Just a few yellow lights you could see around here and there. You could see over here an orderly room, and you walk past the orderly rooms hour after hour. You walk past orderly rooms, and once in a while there's a guy on guard duty, and you just sort of walk. And I'm feeling cold now, and my uniform is scratching, and I'm not yet back at the barracks at this point, and I hear a bugle go off. Now, this was the bugle that they always blow like 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I don't know what they call it. What is the bugle they call, Jack, that goes off before lights out? No, that goes off before. They give a warning blast. Last call. Yeah, you're right. They give a thing like says, you better get back from the club, Dad, or you're going to miss bed check, is what it really says. And so I hear that bugle go, and I'm about a half a block or so from home sweet home, which was number 714A, or was it D? It was the big white one there. and I'm walking along, and I'm on my way to this barracks when I have missed bed check. Tap starts to blow. Well, it was cold. The wind was blowing in off the lake. And taps is a mournful sound at best. It's one of the most beautiful of all bugle calls. I don't think anyone can argue that. No matter how hip you are, you just something happens when you hear taps. It just happens. That's it. Well, they start blowing this thing, and it's coming from loudspeakers somewhere around the camp, and you can hear it echoing, and it's echoing from the barracks, and it's just so black you can't see the inside of your hand. It's so black. And you can see a yellow, these are not cozy-looking lights that you see in an army camp. Just sort of yellow squares, sordid yellow squares, like naked yellow light bulbs. You don't get the feeling of flickering flames on friendly hearths at all. Well, I hear the sound of this taps, and I'm about maybe a block or so from my little pad, which I shared with 75 other confused guys. And they were already ostensibly in the sack. And I'm walking along all by myself. I see the lights go out. Now it is totally dark, except for the orderly rooms that are lit up. You could see a day room here and there in one of the permanent companies still lit. But all the training companies and all the shipping companies' day rooms went out. The OD walked around with the CQ, and they checked it. You see, there was nothing there, nothing stirring, because you were confined to your barracks. Well, I'm walking along when this guy starts to walk next to me, and it's the CQ. And it's dark. CQ is the charge of quarters, and he is a corporal from the regular company. He says, where you been, Mac? What company in? And I says, I'm going down to Company G, right up ahead. And he says, where you been? I said, I'm down to Service Club 2. And I still have the civilian attitude, you know, sort of, well, he recognized this. And he says, well, look, Mac, you better get in before the OD comes around. They're checking beds. They're starting at the other end of the street. You better get in. Well, I had maybe another 100 yards, and taps is still going. It is still pa pa pi pa pa poo. And it's floating over that cold, cold loudspeaker into that cold ambient air coming off of Lake Michigan and whistling down from the Sioux, coming down from the upper straits of Michigan and Mackinac. Oh, boy. And that thing is echoing. Well, now it has stopped. Dead silence. The instant after taps is the instant it begins to soak into you. Just dead silence. And I see that company door step up there. You know, you see the barracks, little steps going up ahead of me, and I'm walking along. I get up on the steps, and that cold wind is whistling down the company street. There is not a single soul anywhere stirring, except for one thing. Way down at the end of the street, they had these wooden sidewalks, you know, made of slats. The street itself was just gravel and clay. I could hear the sound of big, heavy GI official OD boots. Plunk, plunk, clunk. I could hear that clunk, plunk, clunk, dunk, 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 dunk. Somebody checking the barracks. The sound of absolute blind, cold, bitter cold, after taps authority. No trace of humanity. Just that after tap sound of somebody checking the barracks. Well, I stood up on the porch, and I could hear the sound of those footsteps, and I could hear the doors clunking once in a while, and then he crosses the street. You clunk, clunk, and you hear a little talk. The OD's talking to the CQ. They're cutting across to the other barracks. The wind is whistling, and they've got about maybe four or five barracks before they hit my pad. And I'm looking down the company street, and I see a GI truck make a turn down there, one of these great big troop carriers with a big canvas top. Oh, boy, that does not look like a Galaxy convertible, I'll tell you that. And the sound of a GI truck, just after lights out, with the wind blowing from the lake, is one of the most chilling mechanical, warlike sounds that I know of. The sound of gunfire is not a warlike sound. The sound of great big cold machines moving in the darkness is much, much scarier. Well, I hear the sound of this truck, and it goes, there's a certain kind of gears that the GI trucks have. They're very low gears that are made for climbing up the White Cliffs of Dover under heavy gunfire. Yeah, oh, they'll go straight up, and it's going. This guy is dragging God knows what, and it's a great big troop carrier, and he's making a turn down at the end of the company street, and in absolute silence. Boy, that did not sound at all like my V8. Not at all. And then he stops. The sound of that GI engine idling down there at the end of the street, and I could hear those feet going clunk, 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 clunk. Silence. They're checking another barracks. And then clunk, 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 clunk. Checking another barracks. And for some nutty reason, which I will never be able to fathom, looking down over that long street, hanging there in that ice-cold moonlight, it suddenly hit me. And it's the first time it hit me. I remember distinctly that I am the enemy. That to somebody else, I am the hated, feared, bestial enemy, and that he is about to try to kill me. That if he could get here, he would do it. I don't know why it soaked in at that moment. Well, I go into the barracks. Well, the barracks is absolutely pitch black. It's lights out, you know, but there's a lot of guys hollering and yelling, you know, because there's only 3 days in the army and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Hey, Charlie! Hey, Charlie! Hey, what kind? Did you get your coat fixed today? Did they ever forget? What the? Hey, Charlie! Hey, did you ever turn? How about those shoes? You turn them in?
You know, that kind of stuff, and they're yelling back and forth.
Hey, for God's sakes, close the door. You want to freeze, asshole?
Well, it's all like Camp Berrien, which I had attended as a Boy Scout. Because we were all still Boy Scouts. We were all out for a big camping thing. Well, I got back to my pad, and instantly, you know, I forget that moment there out there on that thing. And don't think for 1 minute I'm pretending that I had deep insight. Not at all. The minute I'm back in there, I'm saying, oh, shut up, you nut, for God's sakes. You know, I'm hollering like all the rest of it. And I get back into the pad. I sneak down into my sack, and it's warm there for a minute. I'm laying there, and then I hear outside, I hear that sound. There's a long pause between gear changes in one of those GI troop carriers. Boy, they got a lot of torque going there, and they got a lot of flywheel going, Eddie, and they got a lot of gears going there, and they got a lot of horsepower moving, and they got a lot of tires going. So they do not go through those gears fast. It goes roughly like this. He goes, and I'm laying there in the pad, and it's dark out, and I can hear one or two guys are beginning to cork off. It's getting quieter and quieter. Then I finally quietly slipped off. But every time I hear the word taps, just the word, just the sound, just the idea of taps, I have a faint feeling, you know? Whatever it is, just a faint feeling. Oh, boy. It's a funny business. Now, this is almost exclusively a male thing. I don't know. It is. It's a very, very, it's very difficult to tell this to women. It is. It's truly a male thing, and it's hard to express. And oh, another thing too, it is very difficult to tell this to anybody who has been in the army when it has not been wartime. Not the same thing again at all. It's like when you're doing a play, you know. There's a big difference between just rehearsing and fooling around. And you may work awfully hard at rehearsing. You may sweat. Boy, you may sweat no matter what comes. Boy, it's terrible hard work. It's boring. It's terrible work when you're rehearsing a play. But it's very different the night you hear the people coming in. And you got to go out and do it. Then it's a completely different phenomenon. It has no relationship to the first one. None whatsoever. It's a subtle feeling that I'm sure that most ex-GIs who are hearing this say, yeah, you know. But it's the kind of thing you cannot transmit to anybody else, no matter how hard you write, no matter how many novels you write about it, no matter how many Norman Mailers are around or James Joneses are around. You still cannot transmit that very subtle feeling, whatever it is. That crazy feeling of aloneness, and still, it's a feeling, if you can imagine, Eddie, a feeling of aloneness mingled with a fantastic feeling of being part of an enormous crowd who are all your friends. Now, explain that one. That's just the way it is. It's subtle. Now, you know, you want to hear about the time the guy threw the taps into the PA system? I'll tell you one time. It was the greatest juxtaposed piece of business I've seen in years. It would have done credit to Ingmar Bergman. For using sound at the right moment. And I don't know whatever happened to the guy. I'd like to shake his hand. I know that they said that if they ever caught him, they'd court-martial. Well, there's a great expression that they use in the Army, which has never even appeared in Army stories. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you after we get off the air. It refers to how far you'll court-martial a guy. Oh, yeah, boy. And I heard a lot of loose talk about what they were going to do to this guy if they ever got him, but there was 800 guys that were pulling for him, and it would be pretty hard to get this guy at that, you know, because nobody was talking. Well, here's what happened. It happened at a kind of moment, just a great moment. I'll have to describe the scene. We were all... This group of guys, it was in ASTP. Did you ever hear of ASTP, the Army Specialized Training Program? Well, now, that's not like ROTC. I'll tell you that right offhand. And there were a lot of guys in ASTP who were not just college guys. ASTP, in certain instances, was composed mostly of guys who had spent like a year and a half in foxholes. You know, guys who had spent a lot of time ducking all kinds of metal. Guys that have been in all kinds of... Oh, boy, I would love to use some of the real GI expressions here to tell you what kind of duty that many of these guys had had. You know, they'd been there, you know, and a lot of them. And so by dint of one fluke or another, they had applied for this great thing. It was like applying for heaven. You know, it's like filling out the forms to be sent to paradise. You know, you couldn't believe it ever happened. What would you do if a guy put on the bulletin board of the company tomorrow morning, we are accepting a few applicants for Nirvana. As of 0800 tomorrow morning, we will interview applicants to be sent directly without any stops for fines or other problems. We'll be sent directly to heaven. And there you will become permanent party. This is a very special deal that we've worked out. Now, of course, you don't ever expect to have that happen. While you're marching through the sludge and the rain is coming down and you can hear, whoa, this guy goes past with 50 caliber machine going and everybody is running and this stuff is flying. Well, guys are applying for this, you see. Well, by some strange magic, these guys suddenly find themselves literally there. They're in heaven, you know. They're really there. Well, you can't believe it. Can't believe it. And they're all in school. And, it's funny. You know, you know what I'd like? I can't describe to you how escaping from the troops and getting to college, guys were carrying as high as 40 credit hours solids. Stuff like quantum mechanics, advanced physics, advanced analytical, organic chemistry, Sanskrit. They were carrying it all. And not only that, getting A-plus grades out of sheer fear. You'd be surprised what motivation will do. All they suggested once in a while was, well, the troops are waiting. All you got to do is slip a little in your grades. The troops are waiting. Well, you never saw more books being cracked. The only time in my life I actually, you know, you hear about guys pounding their head against the wall. Did I tell you about that night? I am sitting, I'll tell you, it was pure hell. I cannot describe to you. You guys have all studied. All of you have studied at one time or another in your life. Well, can you imagine studying in wartime, in the worst part of the war, too? I mean, this is not when, like, everybody's winning. The worst part of the war, you are studying, well, I'll tell you the courses we were taking. Physics, chemistry, calculus, geography, English literature, history, military science. Oh, you haven't even come to the string. We were taking, you want to hear the rest of it? Anyway, the point being, we were taking roughly 40 credit hours per semester. Well, now we were, and most of the guys, a lot of the guys had been out of school for a couple of years, out of high school. And so it was a terrible thing to try to get back into studying. And guys had been in the Army, you know, many of them had been overseas. A lot of guys had been shot at, everything else. So here they're frantically trying to get caught up and trying to work like men. And they gave us grades. We were in the civilian classes. They were not special classes. So here you were sitting next to guys who were taking 15 credit hours, and they were taking one solid, and they were majoring in gym and football. And all the while you're trying to do it. And each professor, by the way, thought his class was the most important class for a guy who was going to go out and get his head shot off against the Japanese. And so they insisted. I mean, all the way down the line, even the history professors, they flunk you right out. Well, if you flunk one course, in fact, they said if you got a C on any of the courses, forget it. It was the boat. And they were putting you in as infantry replacement in combat divisions already in the line, which meant a C today, tomorrow the Tiber. You know? A C today, tomorrow the Po Valley. Well, of course, you never saw more studying in your life. Oh, it was just fantastic. You never saw what motivation will do. I mean, superhuman learning was going on. You could literally see the steam coming out of guys' ears. It was just fantastic. You know, guys think that they've worked under Duras. Well, I'll tell you, there's no Duras like that. Because about every 3 or 4 days, a couple of guys would disappear. And we would hear about them, oh, my God, no, the 103rd, oh, 75% casualties in the last 24 hours alone. We would get the reports back from the front. Did you hear what happened to Murphy in the English class? No. Well, he's at Walter Reed. Already? Yep, Walter, basket case, you know. Oh, no. 7 minutes after he left the English class, boom, they sent a shell over, you know, and got him. There he was caught right there with his rules of grammar in his hand. Well, you know, you'd be surprised what motivation will do. Well, and everybody, you know, because we had lights out. Lights out was automatic, but nobody slept. Nobody slept 24 hours round the clock we worked. Absolutely. You could not afford sleeping under those conditions. Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting in there, you see, and I've got the shades pulled down, and me and Goldberg's on the other side of his desk, both of us, you see, we're roommates. We are really sweating it off. Oh, we're working like fiends. You know, we got flashlights and we're working. And suddenly I hear bloomp, bloomp on the wall. I actually hear gunk, gunk. Oh, very funny sound. Gunk, gunk. Gunk, gunk, gunk. Like that. Gunk. And then I hear a little muttering. Gunk, gunk, gunk. And finally, you know, I wonder what the devil's going on. It's just a real... It was a terrible earth sound. You know, the kind of sound like bloody, pulpy stumps being ground into the concrete. I hear gunk, gunk, gunk. Oh, it sounded awful. Gunk, gunk. Well, finally, I goes to the door, and I pulls my door open. I creeps out into the darkened hall, afraid of the CQ. You know, my head is spinning with integral calculus, and I've got everything going. And I hear it coming out of the next room. Gunk, gunk. And I knock on the door. It stops for a minute. Gunk, gunk, gunk. And then I hear this voice. It's Roswell T. Edwards from Brockton, Mass. He says, what do you want? I said, what's that sound? Gasser's hitting his head on the wall because he can't get the integral. I said, what? And I open the door, and here is this GI hitting his head on the wall. He can't get it in. He can't get the ideas. Boom, boom. I said, cut it out, Gasser. Cut it out. It won't help.
Coming to WOR TV this fall.